1 minute away.
Now, Bill, you don't have to project your voice, or it's a friendly conversation, and you, but you should look at me during the response.
Right.
I'll kind of nod my head athletically and put the two on you, so that you're special. Okay, I thought one of the most enlightening parts of your talk had to do with the domino theory. And as you begin your comments, would you say something about, like, the domino theory is spoken of condescendingly in the PBS series or something like that, and then explain why you think it was a valid concept?
Well, I don't recall what the PBS series said about the domino theory, but this was a general criticism of those who opposed our involvement in the war. They said this was invalid, and it was nonsense to believe that South Vietnam went, that other countries in Southeast Asia would go. But as I would like to point out, the only people that didn't believe in the domino theory were the critics over here, and I suppose some in Europe as well. But Asian leaders believed in it. The communist leaders believed in it. You can get some very good quotes from the communist press, Peking, Moscow, and Hanoi, expressing the belief in the domino theory. And if, when Vietnam went communist, that was early on, that this would be a base for communist operations throughout all of Southeast Asia, and eventually the quote, revolution, unquote, would prevail in Southeast Asia. So it was firmly believed by, in Asia, by both communists and non-communists.
And one of the things
I'd like to also point out is that we saw it once demonstrated when the Japanese went into what is now Vietnam. That was the beginning of the end for all of Southeast Asia. They used that as a base of operation and expanded throughout Southeast Asia in 1941. And that's what eventually got us into the war, most people don't realize.
Now, you anticipate one of the criticisms of what you've said. The people have said, well, in 1975, only two dominoes fell. Could you start off by saying something about the critics might say and then respond to the criticism?
Yes, well, they point out that only two fell, but I would like to make the point that had we not been involved quite a long time and massively in Vietnam, that a number of other dominoes probably would have fallen. Now, one could never demonstrate this, but knowledgeable Indonesians have told us that the communist coup in Indonesia in September 1965 might well have succeeded had not our intervention, our previous intervention in Vietnam, that is the previous spring, not created a psychological atmosphere which was conducive to a resistance to communism and to such communist coups. Now, if Indonesia would have succumbed to communism, that would have been an enormous loss for the West. I mean, Indonesia has been the sixth most populous country in the world, stretched 4,000 miles, controls the straits between the Pacific and the Indian Ocean, very rich in oil, rubber, other minerals, and would have been a horrendous loss, and it would certainly have had enormous repercussions throughout all of Southeast Asia.
How do we account for the fact that the communists believed in the domino theory? People in the State Department and the White House believed in it, but the general population was told that this was a silly concept.
Well, those who opposed our involvement in the war naturally criticized any rationale for our involvement in the war. We wanted to put across the idea that we had no national interest there, and that it was a nationalist movement, it would have been confined to Vietnam, at the most perhaps spill over into the other Indochinese countries, but that we had, because of that, there was no business in our being out there. It was a local event, would have no wider repercussions than simply the communist domination of one country, which is a long ways off from the other side of the world.
Now, one of the related arguments, of course, was that Ho Chi Minh was strictly a nationalist, like Tito, and you had some interesting comments. Would you begin your remarks by saying that people often argued that Ho was a nationalist?
Well, this has been still argued.
Would you state that?
This is one of the principal rationales against our involvement in Vietnam. Ho was a nationalist. He simply wanted freedom, quote-unquote, and independence for Vietnam, freedom from colonial power and influence first against the French, and what the communists would call neo-colonialist influence of the United States later. Ho himself would have been absolutely appalled had he been called a national communist by any other communist. I mean, he was one of the last of the old international communists, firmly believed in the solidarity of the world communist movement, and so said in his last testament, which was published just after his death in September 1969, where he appealed to the Soviet Union and China to heal their differences and reestablish the unity of the world communist movement. He organized the Indo-Chinese Communist Party back in 1930 on orders from Moscow. He was a Comintern agent. Comintern, the Communist International, was an international subversive organization under the direct control of Moscow. And you don't have to take my word for it. The official North Vietnamese party history makes it quite clear. In fact, states that the Comintern said, well, he's then called Wen Ai Quoc. He had about at least 11 different aliases. Sent him out there to pull together the three competing communist parties in Indochina and to unite into one party, the Indo-Chinese Communist Party. That was in Hong Kong, 1930. That party still exists. It's still the Indo-Chinese Communist Party, although it's called different things for tactical reasons. But there's one party that is intended to dominate all of Indochina. And that's always been their objective since 1930. And that's why Hanoi will not give up on Cambodia and has already, of course, complete control of Laos. Because that's their old dream going back to 1930. When Tito was expelled from the Cominform in 1948 as a, quote, nationalist or communist, one of the most vociferous critics of Tito was Ho Chi Minh. If he'd have been a national communist, he would have welcomed Titoism. In fact, he abhorred Titoism, everything it stood for. So one can go on and on, but he is, by communist documentation, he is anything in the world of a national communist. Never believed in it. And it's been more closely allied with the Soviets than probably anybody else. And we see that now, of course, after the communists succeeded in conquering all of Vietnam. What did they do? But it's sign a mutual assistance pact with the Soviet Union. They joined the Soviet-dominated CEMA, that's the Council for Economic Cooperation among the communist countries. And they have given the Soviets the use of a large base at Cam Ranh Bay, which we built up at considerable expense, the American taxpayer. Now they use it as an air and naval base, which enables them to project their power throughout all of Southeast Asia and into the Indian Ocean to an extent they couldn't have without that the use of that base. So they're very, very solidly in the Soviet bloc, by their own admission, by Soviet admission. And that was what a lot of us predicted would happen if we lost the war in Vietnam. So it's created a difficult strategic problem for the non-communist countries in Southeast Asia, including the United States.
Okay, that's a real fine answer. I appreciate that compression. I'd like to move on to the one of your opening remarks. You said we did the morally right thing in the wrong way, and I wonder if you would... Yes, sir. I wonder if you would iterate that statement. We did the morally right thing in the wrong way, and then expand on your notion of what that means.
Well, I would say more generally we did the right thing, period. Not just the morally right thing, but I think we were acting in our national interest at the time and trying to prevent the spread of communism. Communism in Southeast Asia, allied, abetted, supported by major communist powers. So it was in our national interest. We did the right thing in our national interest. Certainly from a moral point of view, what we were trying to prevent came to pass, and the results were horrendous for the people of Indochina. I don't have to go into details. Everybody's aware of the hundreds of thousands of boat people who've lost their lives fleeing from Vietnam, from the oppression, tens of thousands of the people are still in concentration camps in Vietnam. The millions that were killed, and probably the worst example of genocide in modern history, in proportion to the population. Certainly, the Holocaust was, in terms of absolute numbers, was greater, but in terms of the numbers of people affected, this is the worst example of genocide probably in history. And that was the sort of thing we were fighting to prevent, and lots of us predicted that, and we were laughed at by those who opposed our involvement in the war. They said there will be no bloodbath. Well, certainly there wasn't the direct bloodbath in Vietnam that could have happened, which was we got a preview of during the Hue massacre in 1968, where the communists came in and systematically executed, rounded up by name and executed thousands of people in Hue and took public credit for it. Nobody's ever heard of the Hue massacre. Everybody's heard of My Lai, which was an aberration. It was done contrary to orders. It was a young officer who lost his balance and perspective and did something which is not defensible, but it was an aberration. But what the Vietnamese did in Hue was it was a matter of deliberate policy, which they publicly acclaimed. Now, with that sort of example, people had every reason to believe there would be a bloodbath. They thought better of it for probably as much for public relations purposes as any other reason, but also maybe for economic reasons, because their manpower pool was such that they couldn't afford to kill off a large number of their own.
Okay, I think that's all, except for maybe one more question. The conference that we're at and the program that's going to come from it is going to focus to a certain degree on the PBS series. But the PBS series, we think, merely carries forward a lot of the journalistic errors that took place during the Vietnam era. And I wonder, as someone who's worked in Vietnam, in the embassy, worked in Washington, the State Department, and elsewhere, if you could kind of reflect on the problems of conducting an aggressive and responsible foreign policy when what you do is misreported, misinterpreted, and miscommunicated to the American people.
Well, it's enormously difficult.
I wonder if you could state the issue and then...
I think you, in a way, you stated it yourself, because the American public depends on the media for their information, and they were outrageously ill-informed about what was going on in Vietnam during the whole war. The example of the Hue massacre, the scanty coverage of the Hue massacre, as opposed to the enormous coverage the My Lai massacre got, is another good example. An example that's been cited by a number of people is the coverage that the communist successes during the Tet Offensive got, but the fact that it turned into a military and political disaster for the communists was never reported. Another scandalous example is there was never a word in any American newspaper or no footage at all in the television media about the land reform in South Vietnam, which was one of the most successful in history. Nobody got any credit for that. The peasants knew that. When it started, 60% of the peasants had no land. At the end of it, which it ended in 71, they all had land and they were prospering. They were doing extremely well. That was never reported. And I've talked to correspondents when I was stationed in Vietnam for a year and a half. I talked to correspondents covering the war, and they said if we report a positive story, it doesn't get used. It's not newsworthy. So the young, career-oriented, ambitious correspondents that were mostly covering that war, who never covered another war, and war was a new thing to them in the first place, knew that they were going to make their career by emphasizing the negative aspects. So that was another factor, but the end result is that the U.S., the executive branch of the government, lost the support of the people and of the Congress most particularly, and South Vietnam and all of Indochina was foredoomed as a result. it's more complicated than that. I don't think it's fair to blame the media entirely for the loss of the war in Vietnam. There were, you know, mistakes that were made in the course of that war, and I say we did the right thing in the wrong way. I think that we should have sent volunteers. Vietnam were prepared to stay 2 or 3 years. I fought in World War II, and I went into that war fighting out in the Pacific. We had no guarantee when we would get home. We were going to stay there till the war was over. More, we should have started training the Vietnamese sooner, because once we did train them, once they took over the ground battles themselves, in the early 70s, they did very well against the 72 offensive, which was much more massive than the 68 Tet offensive. They acquitted themselves extremely well, and in fact pushed the enemy back in their strongest sector, leading Hanoi to believe it could no longer win the war. It was losing, which indeed it was, losing to Vietnamese, supported by U.S. air and naval support. But they were doing the ground fighting, and they were winning. And that's when they got interested in negotiations. And that happened in September of 1972, excuse me. And we, our negotiations began with the North Vietnamese in Paris in October 1972, at which for the very first time they were willing to make concessions, because they knew they couldn't go on. And had we been able to sustain our support, not do the fighting ourselves except for air support, but give them the sort of support that they needed, I think the outcome would have been quite different. Now, the North Vietnamese Chief of Staff, General Ban Thien Dung, wrote a very interesting series of articles for the party newspaper, which appeared a couple of months after their, you know, victory in South Vietnam, in which he, if you strip away all the propaganda and the verbiage, he attributed their victory in large measure to withdrawal of U.S. support from the South Vietnamese. That was a key factor, according to the communists themselves. So that was the tragedy of the war, is that, as some people say, we snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. And would be not need to have gone that way. I'm not saying that it would have been easy to have won it, but the South Vietnamese were on their way to winning the war, and they recognized, the North Vietnamese recognized it. But we didn't. We were fed up with the war. Henry Kissinger and the president, at that time I was in the White House working for Henry Kissinger, felt that there was no longer public support, and that we had to get the best sort of deal that we could, which turned out to be not very good, because the North Vietnamese violated virtually every article of the peace agreement we signed with them at the beginning of 73, before the ink had dried. And they continued violating in a massive way. And when I was with Kissinger, when we went to Paris to try to work out some modalities for eliminating these violations, this was in May and in June. In June, Kissinger said that if they continue, the United States may well have to take military action again. And they leaned, the North Vietnamese leaders who were there, Lê Duc Tho, who's a senior member of the Politburo, and Nguyen Coc Thuc, who is now the foreign minister of Vietnam, sat back and laughed at us. They said, you evidently don't understand what's going on in your own Congress. At that point, I knew the war was lost, the cause was lost, because we couldn't lay a glove on them anymore. They were home free, and they knew it. They just sat back and laughed at us. That was the end. You want to know how it was lost? At that point, we knew it was lost. They just totally ignored the finally negotiated, worked out agreement that we made with them. And they admitted it. This report I was referring to by General Ban Thien Dung openly admits they were violating the agreement. They didn't care anymore. They didn't worry about the PR aspects. They admitted they were in the South. The North never admitted they had troops in the South publicly until it was all over. And they also changed the name of the party from the Workers' Party, which had been sort of an anodyne name, to the Vietnamese Communist Party. They did that after they succeeded. They didn't worry about PR anymore and deceiving the American public and the rest of the world. They just laughed at us after they'd won, laughed at our gullibility.
I'd like to change the subject just a little bit, but it's on everybody's mind, it's in the newspaper every day. We hear, and here again, it's not, this is not directed towards your remarks downstairs, but more your experience and background in the State Department, the White House. We're hearing a lot about the no more Vietnams, the lesson of Vietnam, or lessons of Vietnam, and I wonder, leading off by saying something like, well, people are talking about the lessons of Vietnam, maybe you could indicate what are fake or false lessons, and what are perhaps some of the true lessons of the Vietnam experience.
Well, there are a lot of people who have made the point that you shouldn't get involved in something.
Well, could you start off by saying that the people are talking about the lessons of
Vietnam? Well, the lessons of, yes, the people are talking about the, you know, the so-called lessons of Vietnam. Well, the lessons of Vietnam are many. One quite obvious lesson, you have to have public support of the public and the Congress if you want to get involved in that sort of action again. In fact, it's now as a result of the misreading and misunderstanding of the whole Vietnam experience that it's difficult, for example, to get the support that is needed for the government in El Salvador to compete with the communist insurgency. I mean, we've got, you know, 55 U.S. advisors down there, and this is considered to be sort of massive U.S. intervention by some people. Whereas right now, next door in Nicaragua, for example, there are 9,000 Cubans, 3,000 of whom are military advisors, and we've got a few hundred Soviets and other East Europeans. Nobody talks about that. The focus is all on a relatively small number of American advisors who are not going to combat down there. So this is a direct result of the you know, the so-called Vietnam syndrome, that it's difficult for the United States to get involved in any area, not even so remote. And as you've heard the president say, you know, Central America is not that remote from the United States. So it's and it has a the additional, I'd say more of a disadvantage, is it carries with it an additional danger, is that it could lead the Soviets to believe that they can go into certain areas that may turn out to be in our interest, to prevent them from going into it, with impunity. As long as with this they feel that they've felt they've had more of a free hand. And look at the record. After the fall of Vietnam, the Soviets got involved massively in Angola, Ethiopia, and in Yemen, for example, not massively, but certainly involved there. And then finally we have Afghanistan. I mean, they felt with the current mindset in the United States that they can get involved in these operations with impunity, or relative impunity. I think they're cautious. I mean, they're not going to get directly involved in an area that they think we may have to react. But still, it's changed the whole psychological atmosphere in their favor, which they quite openly admit that this is a... Plus, the improvement in their military postures also played a role in all of this.
Final question, talking about perception of foreign affairs through media. Could you say something, if you feel strongly about what television does to the situation? Television and the perception of happenings thousands of miles away, television and its influence on the general public and its ability to understand complex issues.
Well, that is...
Let's start with something about television.
Yes, the problem with television, especially news coverage, is that it's very extremely superficial and depends on dramatic episodes and presentations, like Maurice Safer's famous shot of the Marines burning thatched burning houses in Vietnam, the first little girl running down the street after having an accidental napalm, and so forth and so on. Very strong visual impact that you get not only from television, but from photos as well. But if you read, as you've done in making transcripts of this series, for example, it's extremely superficial. That's brought home by how how few words appear on a piece of paper as opposed to print media, for example. And I think that most people in the United States get their information on foreign affairs through television. As you know, the bulk of newspapers in the United States don't have very much foreign coverage. In fact, some have none. I mean, we can't look upon the papers in the East Coast and the West Coast and a few in the Middle West. It's been typical or atypical. So where do they get their news or information from? Mostly from television. And it's in the very nature of news television coverage, it's bound to be superficial. And that's the unfortunate thing I felt about the PBS series, is that they finally do something in depth, although it's not the network, it was PBS. And there are so many distortions and inaccuracies. It's very, very distressing. Now, there was a golden opportunity to present a balanced record. And I'm not saying it would have all redounded necessarily to the favor of the whatever administration was in power at the time of the segment shown, because certainly each administration made mistakes. But with some balance, it would have been a totally different kind of production. Now, I took copious notes throughout the whole series. I say I missed one or two. And I had, I would say, probably a couple of sheets of corrections and comments on virtually every one. Now, there were some segments which were all right. Some parts, well, on the whole, it certainly left you with a totally unbalanced view of the war and our whole effort. Especially those segments. And I was most annoyed by the segment which showed the North Vietnamese without identifying them as such. Now, I know they're old Vietnam hands who wouldn't know who they were. I happen to have been so involved in the study of the other side, I recognize some of their names and faces. But the average person, even the person who knows quite a bit about Vietnam, would not necessarily know they were communists. And certainly the average American or the average viewer wouldn't have the foggiest notion they were. The ones can sort of go on and on. But that was one sort of salient criticism that I had initially. There's no earthly reason why they couldn't have been identified. And they weren't as to who they were.
William, it's been an excellent interview, and I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you.
Went real well. And the pipe was no problem, by God.
No, I didn't try to get too much.
It's a scholarly touch, the whole thing.
Could you hold your pipe in that hand and just let us make a shot of it in case we need to cut away?
Yeah, they need to do a few cutaways during the editing phase.
Yes, I've done this before. Uh-huh. I've gone through the pipe routine.
All right.
Last time I was interviewed by Washington Television, they did the same thing. Except they edited all the good parts out and used the parts which are out of context, which are not too...
Well, sure, that's what we're going to do, too. Right?
Yeah. Are you really going to introduce me? I'd sort of rather be introduced as a professor at Georgetown University, that's okay.
Yeah. Political science?
School of Foreign Service. I'm actually a professor of international relations.
Okay, that's fine. International Relations, I'll remember that. Do you know William Adams? Is he a colleague of yours?
The name is familiar, but I don't...
He's over in another division of your school.
Yeah, I know the name.
And he studies the influence of media and foreign policy receptions and that sort of thing.
Have you
He's associated with the George Washington Vanderbilt Annex.
Have you read Martin Hertz's monogram on Vietnam? He just died. He was a retired ambassador. He did quite a good job.
I have not, but I plan to this year. So it's one of those things that's on my list.
We're not still on camera, are we?
No, we're
it's not for interview purposes. They were just getting some...